dozens of innocent victims shot down at a gay nightclub in Orlando. Our country is reeling from the worst terrorist attack since 9/11, and it was in our home state. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at BayCareEvents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sussingham. On the show today, we'll get some analysis of the terrorist attack in Orlando with experts in law enforcement and military intelligence. But first, Abe Abaraya joins us from Orlando. Abe is a reporter for WMFE and for Health News Florida. Abe, first, I just wanted to say how sorry I am that you and your city had to go through this horrible time.
That's greatly appreciated. The outpouring of support from around the world has been really touching as someone who lives here.
Oh, I'm glad. You did a lot of reporting from an LGBT community center. Could you describe the scene there?
You know, this is sort of a place where people were gathering. This is a very tight-knit community, the LGBT community in Orlando. So there were a lot of people who were just very fearful. They, at that point in time, they were saying, we don't know. You know, it's not a question of if, but when. You know, they expected to know people who were impacted by this. And so there was a lot of people waiting around for news and, you know, a lot of people hugging. And it was just a very tense scene in Orlando. But there was also a lot of outpouring of support. You know, when I was there, you couldn't go 10, 15 minutes without someone offering a bottle of water, food. And this was being collected at the center. It was being driven to the families who were waiting. So there, and then obviously the lines for blood donations that were, you know, wrapping around buildings, and one blood actually saying, we have enough for today. You know, we're at capacity. Please come back tomorrow and the next day as we, you know, the need will continue.
So many people wanting to do something to contribute in some way. So, Abe, what has stayed with you the most through this reporting?
I think the thing that I'm never going to be able to forget is, you know, speaking with people who were, I spoke to someone who was at the nightclub at the initial shooting. You know, his story was just incredibly powerful of, you know, he brought someone outside, they were with them. And you have to remember at this time when the initial scenes happened, they weren't able to get EMS onto the scene because there were fears of, you know, that there could be a bomb, there could be some other, it wouldn't be safe for EMS. So there were people who were waiting to get transported. Police were coming in with pickup trucks, any kind of vehicle they could, and sort of acting as interim transport.
Abe, can you tell us a little bit about what this person told you that had been in the nightclub and had survived it?
You know, he talked about how he actually, he was with a woman who'd been shot, and he called her mother and got her on the phone and was talking to her through it. And when she started getting pale, he brought her, you know, tried to actually find someone to take her to the hospital, that, you know, this was someone who couldn't wait. So he, you know, kind of essentially helped to transport, you know, get someone else, another victim, to the hospital quicker.
That's Abe Abaraya, reporter with WMFE in Orlando, talking to us from the scene in Orlando. Thanks so much, Abe, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest today in the studio, retired U.S. Army Colonel Derek Harvey. He's a senior fellow at the University of South Florida's Global Initiative for Civil Society and Conflict, heavily involved in Middle East issues. He served as a special advisor to General David Petraeus and is a former Defense Intelligence Agency senior leader at CENTCOM. And Dave Couvertier is a recently retired FBI agent with 33 years in law enforcement and SWAT, as a hostage negotiator and a spokesman for the department. Thanks so much, both of you, for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Dave, what happens when the FBI learns that there's an active shooter? What are the dynamics of that situation?
When the FBI looks at you know, naming or classifying an event as an active shooter situation, it is specifically a situation where an individual is actively engaged in the killing or attempted killing of people in a populated area, and usually in a confined area, such as the nightclub.
Derek.
Yes, during an active shooter situation like what we had at the Pulse in Orlando, you know, one of the things that we learned in combat operations is the importance of the golden hour. That's the first hour after somebody's wounded. And any delay that you have in exfiltrating the wounded dramatically increases the mortality of the victims. So the question that will have to be answered is, what sort of delay was there and what sort of exfiltration was going forward during those 2.5 hours?
Was it three hours until they started going in? Do you have any idea about that, Dave?
Yeah, I just want to say the colonel's definitely correct on the and being a former SWAT operator, a former military member as well. I really that resonates with me because that was the mindset is that first hour, which is true. In this situation, you had an active shooter situation that actually turned into a hostage situation, changing the dynamics. Not sure why, they held back or they pulled back. That's information that the investigation is going to reveal, and those are issues that we'll look back later. But right now, based on what we know, it sounded that the negotiators were able to get him on the phone rather quickly and were able to engage him. And as a former hostage negotiator, that's a plus, because if you got him engaged in conversation, he's not actively hurting other people.
Derek, you've said that there are obstacles now to, you've heard from your FBI friends, that there are obstacles to their investigations.
Yeah, one of the things that we know is that extremist mass, and they do exist, create an environment and provide a venue for associations. And these associations create the networks. And the mosque is considered a safe place for that type of association. And what I'm hearing is that the policies are that following the leads to get at the source of where this hate and where these associations and networks can flourish are being restricted by policy. And the policies at a higher level restrict the follow-through on investigations that might be able to lead to connecting the dots and building an understanding of a network, the motivations, the interests, and the capabilities behind a person like Omar Mateen, or in the case of San Jose. And in both cases, we had extremist mosques. These people were well known as being potentially violent. They had associations. People did know. Political correctness, in some ways, has intimidated people.
And I totally agree with that in the sense that the society will follow its leadership. If the leadership is subscribing to a particular philosophy, that will trickle down to the lower levels of society in every community, every neighborhood.
The challenge in this conflict within Islam is there are these marginal elements that, have influence in a number of mosques. And within the doctrine itself, whether it's in the Quran or in the Hadith, the sayings and teachings of the Prophet, there is a strong anti-LGBT trend in there. And if you look in the Middle East, about half the countries have a death sentence for gay behavior. And then in other places, it's floggings and prison time and that type of thing. And even in many mosques, Sunni mosques in particular, to include the Baltimore mosque that the president went to after the San Bernardino bombing, the imam there is a very outspoken critic of the gay lifestyle and is promoted and called for draconian measures to be taken against gays. And that's what we've had here in a mosque in the Orlando area that Omar Mateen apparently went to. And this is traditionally in the culture of places like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq.
His parents were from Afghanistan, although they have said that religion had nothing to do with the actions taken here. And there has been a distinction made about ISIS and Islamic cultures when it comes to homosexuality. Do you think that's correct?
I see that the death sentence is being imposed in Saudi Arabia, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan for homosexuality. And in the Pew research results, polling results, there is a overwhelming majority of people that support draconian measures against the gay community in these countries. That translates into a number of the mosques and the way imams are communicating the ideology in the United States. Omar was apparently, you know, angered because he's reported to have seen, you know, men kissing, and he had his child with him, and he was very upset about that. Whether that was the triggering thing or not, we don't know. We will never know. But there is a cultural, religious dynamic here that plays into it, and we're putting our head in the sand like an ostrich if we don't recognize that there is that dynamic. And that's where we need groups like CARE and community organizers in the
CARE
Islamic—
CARE is the Council for American Islamic Relations.
Absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And what we need is a community effort to address openness, this idea of reporting and suppressing these extremist views, and, you know, isolating and negating the influence of imams that are promoting hate.
But Derek, the imams came out immediately in Orlando and across the country condemning this in the strongest terms. I mean, there's no way that they are promoting something like this to happen.
But there are the sermons. There are the recordings out there. You know, the Baltimore Mosque, the one in right here in Orlando where Omar went. Those things are on YouTube, and the transcripts are out for people to read. Now, that is a very small perspective, because most overwhelmingly, and this is about building a community and a bridge, and understanding where these pockets of extremism, whether it's right-wing extremism, anti-abortion extremism, wherever it is, we need to come together to fight it.
And let me say this, that's the nail right there. I mean, he just hit the nail on the head. When we're talking about radicalization and extremism, that is a major tool that ISIS and others that are anti-U.S., that are anti-Western civilization, have been utilizing and continue to utilize in the most effective ways. We have children being radicalized online by ISIS in great numbers, to the point that the FBI last year put out a free link website that's called Don't Be a Puppet, and it deals with trying to counter extremism and radicalization, and trying to teach that not only to our children but also to our community leaders, our teachers, because, as Derek just mentioned, we have to come together and fight that, and that is extremism, radicalization. That is the dynamic and the platform that ISIS is using very effectively to radicalize our youth, to brainwash our youth. And we have had, even in Florida, we've had young men and women approached to the point that one individual was not only identified, groomed, radicalized, but was actually mobilized against his family. And we're talking a 16-year-old. Then it was and knew nothing of Islam, knew nothing of ISIS, was an average American white male living in that type of middle-class family, both professional parents and good kid in school. He was radicalized through access on the Internet.
And so many parents really have no idea what social media their children are using or what they're looking at. And so that would be a very effective tool.
Absolutely.
I'm Robin Sessingham. This is Florida Matters. This is Florida Matters. I'm Robin Sessingham. Our guests are Colonel Derek Harvey, Senior Fellow at USF's Global Initiative for Civil Society and Conflict, and a former Defense Intelligence Agency senior leader, and Dave Couvertier, who recently retired from the FBI and has more than 30 years in law enforcement. We're talking about the Orlando nightclub massacre. You know, some public officials seem to shy away from using the words radical Islamic terror, even jihadism, saying that it's an act of terror or hate. We heard that from President Obama in this instance. And there's certainly the impulse not to offend or hurt people who are of the Muslim faith. But is there some strategic or security reason for speaking that way? Not naming.
I've looked at this extremely closely over the years, when I was active duty, when I was a senior intelligence official, and as an academic. There is no basis for that. If you look at any type of a study, not anecdotally, there are people that raise this issue and they claim Islamophobia. But point of fact, you know, Muslim leaders that I speak to, I spoke to some in Washington, D.C. over the weekend, and the issue is they wish they had a little bit of top cover to focus that and have some clarity about where this threat is in our Islamic community. And they're very specific about where it's coming from. And Middle Eastern leaders, whether it's the president of Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, the Grand Mufti in Cairo, they are very clear about this threat. Nasrallah, the imam from Lebanon for the Shia, he's very clear about this threat. Shia, Sunni. So why are we in the United States unable to define the threat, focus on it like a laser beam, and build the collaboration and teamwork to go after it in a way that doesn't threaten the larger modern reformists within the Islamic community? I am befuddled by this.
We got to call it what it is, and we've got to deal with it openly. If you really want to be transparent, let's be transparent across the board. And the big thing is, we do have to give cover to the religious leaders in the Muslim communities. So many times I've spoken to them from a liaison perspective, and I get the same response that Derek was just mentioning too, is, you know, we need top cover. Everybody's
got to
be on board.
What do you mean by that? We need top cover. I don't understand.
Clarity.
I mean there are religious leaders, there are community leaders, there's professors at the University of Central Florida who are Muslim, who are concerned that if they try to address these issues within their faith, they get pummeled. And there's threats there by some. And part of it is care, you know, according to some people. And within the community who are concerned about opening up the problems within the faithful there. And the top cover provides space for dialogue, for debate. And you're not going to be ostracized. It's not going to be overly politicized with political correctness. And then you can start to focus on those extremist elements within the community.
You know,
and it'll bring us together. I mean, that's the main thing. It'll bring us all together. Once we can slice that piece out of it, the rest of us are all the same.
I think also, just importantly, I think trying to characterize, you know, Chattanooga or Fort Hood or, you know, the other attack in Texas as lone wolves or this one as a lone wolf misses a point, because there's an environment created in certain places in which these people begin to believe that it's okay, that it's all right. It fits in with a narrative and a understanding of the world that they have, that their actions are going to be okay. It's not just the ISIS messaging, okay, on the internet. The ISIS messaging bolsters what the messages they've been hearing in an extremist mosque or in their community. And these messages are about intolerance. They're about a value structure that's very different. It's about a lack of concern for others, that others are less than human. To me, it's no different than a racist in Mississippi in the 1950s that saw others as subhuman. And if that's what they begin to see as a value system around them, then it becomes easy to take this action. And they're not crazy. They're not necessarily unstable.
Well, his wife did say he was mentally ill. So we are hearing that about this.
But she said it based upon his abuse. But if you're in the Middle East, excuse me, Dave, just
okay.
The religious authorities, the state religious authorities in Pakistan just came out with another authoritative declaration reinforcing that it's okay for men to beat their wife for not dressing the way the man wants, or for not having sexual intercourse, or for not preparing the food right. It's okay to beat your wife for those types of things. They gave the religious support for that. It's that type of an environment that creates the abuse. And it's not a big step to go from that to other things. And that's what his wife faced. Even though he was born here, grew up in a societal normative pattern of behavior that said it's okay.
So our public reactions differ from the European terror attacks like those in Paris or Brussels or Tel Aviv. You know, I don't think you hear mention there of gun control or mental illness. I'm wondering what the difference is. Is it a particularly American trait to bring up these other issues? Because we feel like if we can just pass the right law, if we could just get this right, we could fix this.
Well, Dave, you'll probably have more to say on this, but in France, they've got very, very harsh and very strict gun control measures. Yet you still had those violent acts there. The same thing in other countries in Europe. Yet people who want to kill can generally find a way to kill in mass. So in our society, I saw this immediately on social media where reflexively people went to, it's about the guns or it's about mental health. It's not about the guns or mental health, or there's a whole bucket of issues that are entwined.
It could be about everything.
It is.
At the same time. But set off or ignited by extremist
Islam. And that's exactly
Islam.
Right. I mean, when we're talking, again, we got to get back to the main issue. The main issue is extremism. And one of the things that Al-Qaeda, one of the things is ISIS or ISIL, what they do, and the reason they've been so effective is they try to identify individuals with traits that need to be fulfilled. For example, they have emotional discrepancies in their life, or mentally, deficiencies that they try to exploit mm-hmm. through social, you know, engineering, through friendship, and they try to identify the weaknesses. And that's what I refer more than if it's mental or anything else. It's a weakness. What is their weakness, and how can we manipulate this person to carry out what we want them to do? If they find someone who's had a rough upbringing, who is in need of something, whether it be emotionally or, tangibly, that's where they're going to start pulling those strings. And if they're hopeless in their life, it's an easier target to manipulate that person to carry a bomb or carry out some kind of an attack.
Let me ask you before we wrap up, why Orlando? We've heard from President Obama and others saying this could happen anywhere, this could happen to any community. But the fact is that it didn't. It happened in Orlando.
Well, let me just go back here, and let me give you statistics. The FBI actually did a study and released in 2014 on active shooter incidents. And that's why the president and others are saying this can happen anywhere, because it can. The FBI looked at specific cases that actually fit, were defined by the definition of active shooter for us. And we looked at 100, or the FBI looked at 160 incidents that occurred between 2000 and 2013. When we looked at the information, it showed us an average over those 14 years of 11.4 active shooter situations. But what was more telling was the first 7 years, it was 6.4. The second, or the latter 7 years, 16.4. So if you look at that on the chart, it's a direct upward trend as to what we've been experiencing and what we will continue to experience. And we're talking casualties, over 1,000 casualties during that time frame.
I think, Orlando just drew a bad hand, okay? And it could have happened anywhere. And it happened to Orlando because that's where Omar Martin was, and that's where he was angered. Now, the soft target there of the Pulse nightclub, that fit because there's a particular hatred and vitriol directed towards that community. But that community also is easier to target because I would bet that there probably wasn't anyone in there that had a concealed carry permit. It wasn't like a biker's bar or probably a country western club out here in Riverview where you go in there and you're going to find a number of people with concealed carry. So that was, that was part of it. But these targets are being supported and promoted, by ISIS online. Hit the soft targets. And we can harden an airport, go through security, but you could be attacked going in the large queues going in. You can go through the gate right here at the Tampa Coliseum to watch, a hockey game, and you go through security. But the big square out there with thousands of people is vulnerable.
So what should we tell? How should we feel about this? I mean, should we never go to big gatherings? Should we be very careful about going to big gatherings? Should we get a concealed carry? Should we keep our kids inside? How do we process this?
Again, Dave probably has a statistic on this, but the odds are still extremely, infinitesimally small. You're more likely to die in so many other ways, accidental drowning in a bathtub, than you are from a terrorist in the United States. I think that's probably correct, isn't it, Dave?
Absolutely. And I could tell you that the chances of becoming involved in an active shooter situation, as Derek was just mentioning, you have a greater chance of being struck by lightning. But the thing is, when it happens, you need to be prepared and know. And that's what we would do, is live our lives, because we're Americans. We're going to live our way, the American way, enjoy the freedoms that our country gives us, try to work to build those bridges of understanding between different societies, between different, communities. And then we have to focus as a nation at the top, at the top level, right down to the local level, on extremism. And we have to know that is the issue. The issue is extremism of any kind. It doesn't have to be specifically, Islamic extremism. It's just like we looked at crime. Crime occurs everywhere. This is going to occur anywhere as well. But no, we do not fold. We do not hide. We do not stop living. What we have to do is increase our awareness and be prepared. If this happens, what would I do? And then just deal with each case, on its own. And I'll tell you something about the weapons. You can take away every single weapon right now. If we could magically make every single law-abiding citizen turn their weapon in, the bad guys are going to have the weapons. The bad guys are still going to be there. And if you take the weapons away even from them, as Derek mentioned earlier, they'll find other ways to commit carnage. They'll find other ways to intimidate, because that's what terrorism is all about. It's about intimidating and trying to modify and change a society's way of thinking.
So you're not convinced by the gun control argument, then, it sounds.
No, I think it's a responsibility that everybody's got to take very seriously. If you're going to carry, you need to go through the proper training, the background checks, 100%, and you have to be accountable. So that's a big responsibility. And I've carried weapons my entire military career and my entire law enforcement career, and I treat it every day with the same respect, and I never take it for granted. And even now, so that's not going to be the fix. That's not the magic button or the bullet, the silver bullet, okay, that's going to make this all go away.
I agree that it's not a magic bullet, but I still think there are some things. I'm a big pro Second Amendment person, but I still think there are some things that can be done to tighten things up. It'll take some resources.
Absolutely.
And some policy. For example, if he's been investigated, he should go. If he's not on the watch list, he should be on the watch list. And if you're on a watch list, you should be known, and you should have maybe your ability to buy a weapon or to have a weapon removed. But that should also be through a due process procedure where you have an opportunity to reclama in a court system. But that's going to require a fundamental shift in thinking and policy.
I'm going to have to wrap it up, unfortunately. Retired U.S. Army Colonel Derek Harvey, senior fellow at the University of South Florida's Global Initiative for Civil Society in Conflict, and Dave Couvertier, recently retired FBI agent. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you
very much. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. Our engineer is Craig George. I'm Robin Sussingham. Thanks for listening.